my guest, Dr. Avi Loeb, has written a very compelling book called Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth. He makes the case through evidence and observation that this object, Oumuamua, is likely an interstellar spacecraft of some kind, maybe sent here to get our attention. We're going to get into the idea of what an extraterrestrial civilization might be trying to tell us, how society and civilization might change here on Earth if we were to confirm that there are other civilizations out there, intelligent civilizations, what profound effects it might have, and get into some of the other arguments that have been raised by critics of this book and this thesis, who have tended to really stretch the evidence to fit their facts. Science, of course, as Dr. Loeb has told us, you follow the evidence. You follow it wherever it leads. I mean, the purpose of science, of course, is to investigate the unexplained, not to explain the uninvestigated. We're going to do some of that right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Professor Loeb, can you guess how long this object might have been out there? You know, how long it's been floating around? It obviously moves pretty fast, but even at that speed, it would take a long time to get in from another star system, right?
Yes, at that speed, it takes tens of thousands of years to traverse the Oort cloud, the solar system. So it must have been around for a long while, at least millions of years, if not more. That means that the fact that we surveyed the sky and within a few years found an object of that type means that there are many more out there, because otherwise we violate the Copernican principle. The Copernican principle is due to Copernicus, who argued that we cannot be at the center of the universe. There is no reason for us to expect to be in a privileged place. But you can also extend it to a privileged time. So if we looked at the sky for a few years, and this is really the only object that is around, then the chance of us seeing it would be minute, tiny. And so a much more natural approach would be to say, oh, there are many of them, and, you know, we just happened to see the one that was close to us at the time that we were looking. It's just like, you know, when I go to the kitchen and I find an ant, I know that it's not the only ant in the kitchen. There are many more out there. And that causes an alarm, you know, to go off in my in my head, because I need to attend to the fact that there are so many out there. And so that's also a big plus, of course, in the case of Oumuamua, because we haven't gotten enough data on this particular object. So if there are many more out there, then the next sensitive telescope that we are building, the Vera Rubin Observatory, which will have a survey of the sky called LSST, that could find an Oumuamua-like object once every month, if Oumuamua was indeed a member of the population. And so, you know, we can then get much more data on that next object that looks peculiar and understand where it's coming from. It's just like walking on the beach. Most of the time you see natural seashells and rocks, but every now and then you stumble across a plastic bottle, and that indicates that it was artificially made and there is a civilization out there. And so we should do exactly the same type of search. In the past, we've been looking for radio signals. And with that, you know, it really depends on whether you're looking in the right direction at the right time and at the right frequency. And we searched just a small fraction of the parameter space that is possible. But looking for a message in a bottle is a completely different approach. In fact, the so-called Drake equation that is very often mentioned does not apply to messages in a bottle, because if you want to find out the chance of you finding a message in a bottle, it really depends only on the amount of space trash that is out there, the number of objects per unit volume. And whenever you take a snapshot, you will find the nearest one.
And so, of course, if you're not looking for it, you're not going to find it. The same thing with
exactly.
These things.
That's exactly my point, that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy saying, oh, we haven't found anything artificial, because if you're not investing funds in the survey, and if you're ignoring anomalies and always assuming that the future is the same as the past, you will never discover something new. And I just find it really hard to understand how, I mean, all I'm saying is common sense. I mean, it's nothing unusual. And the two of us would not be speaking if everyone would adopt this common sense. So to me, it's really a puzzle. I cannot figure out why I'm the only one saying that.
You know, the march of science, as you note in your book, it's a lesson in humility. The more we learn about the universe, the more humble we become. I mean, you know, Copernicus, we are not the center of the universe. The sun does not revolve around us. We're not particularly special.
This would be pretty
profound, though, if we were to confirm an ET civilization is out there. Can you speculate about the effects on society, on civilization, on our how we would feel, on religion? You think people would freak out or be okay about it?
No, I think it will have a huge impact on all aspects of our life. My hope, I mean, we can talk about this for hours, but my hope is that it will allow us to feel as if we are part of the same team, you know, where one human species, rather than fighting each other, will come together. But I'm not naive, and I know that, you know, it will cause some frustration and in some communities. I mean, you can see that from history, because a person like Giordano Bruno was burned on the stake, you know, because he suggested that the other stars are just like the sun, and they have a planet the size of a planet like the Earth around them, but potentially. He suggested that without having any evidence. And he said, well, maybe there is life there. And the church found it offensive, because they said, well, if there is life there and it sinned, then there should be multiple Christs visiting those different planets and saving them. And the idea of having duplicates of Christ was offensive to the church, and so they burned the guy. So, you know, it goes very deep into very deep convictions that people have. And I think that the best way to approach it for us is to be modest, not to assume we know the answer, not to assume that we are significant, because that turned out that we are unique, we are special, because that turned out to be wrong on every step along the way that, in the past. And I can understand that, because my daughters, when they were infants, they tended to think that they're special and unique. And then they went out to the street and found the other kids and recognized that, you know, they have qualities similar to theirs. And some of them are even better. And so for us to mature as a civilization, the only way to do that would be to go to the cosmic street and find others. And that's what I'm advocating for. But people are not ready to accept this message. And I would think that science of today, you know, we learned so much from history. We got out of this hole of burning people for the wrong ideas, you know. And we should come together around science and celebrate our ability, technological ability, to address this question, rather than put a taboo on it.
Of course, civilizations die. You make the point in your book that, you know, you look around us, what we're doing. You speculate about if there are older civilizations, perhaps they've reached the point where we are, where we have the capability to destroy the planet, where we poison the planet, where we irreversible climate change that destroys life. I mean, whoever sent this thing, assuming they sent it toward us to get our attention, they could be long gone by now.
That's right. But we can still find evidence for those, because they leave behind the relics, and dead civilizations could be identified. And we can learn from a lesson from the fact, you know, if we understand why they died, either due to a nuclear war, perhaps climate change or whatever, we can get our acts together. That would be a lesson in history for what not to do, so that we will not share the same fate. We could also learn from their technologies. If they developed them for thousands of years, we had ours only for a century, and we might learn about new technologies. You can make a profit out of it if you import the technology from the sky that you learn about by looking at the sky, you know, down here on Earth. It's sort of a shortcut, and it feels like copying in an exam, looking over the shoulder of the student next to you. But why not save some time and learn from technologies that are more advanced than we possess right now?
You mentioned in passing the UFO issue, and you're right that a lot of the cases that are presented, the claims that are made, are not supported by evidence. And we explore that a lot. We hear from a lot of people who can't defend the arguments that they make. But as you're probably aware, we now know that the Pentagon has been studying this in secrecy for a long time. They are right now preparing a comprehensive report for Congress, which is deeply interested in the subject. And I wanted to know if you had really dug into it and read any of the literature, some of the more credible stuff, and also whether you are friends with Professor Ashed, the Israeli space scientist who recently made some provocative statements about ET life out there.
Well, let me answer the second part first. I don't know Ashed personally, and I think it's irresponsible of the journalist to report about his story without asking for evidence, because he just made statements without giving even a single document that testifies that what he said what makes sense. And, you know, there are many people that would claim that they are Napoleon or make some statements. And, you know, if you look at their ID, you can tell they are not Napoleon, and Napoleon is dead by now. And if they insist, there are places for those people, you know. And the point is, we should be guided by evidence. And Asher didn't give any evidence. He just made statements. And I think it's really unfortunate that the news media reports about things like that, because there is a lot of noise that has no substance. And by the way, that's one reason why people are afraid of discussing, because there is a lot of noise, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we should minimize the noise. You know, if there is no evidence, if someone tells a journalist this and that, you know, we are used to it in politics. You know, people make statements with no substance. But on such a matter, you know, you need to ask the person, okay, well, how do you prove your point? Do you have any document, anything to show? And if he doesn't, then forget about it. An old person come up with these stories. He can write a book about it. Nobody, you know, it's a free country. He can say whatever he wants, but we don't need to waste time on it. That's the second part of your question. What was the first one? Sorry.
The first part was I mentioned about the Pentagon secret studies, yes, and programs, so, gathering information.
Yeah. So here again, you know, people. So the Pentagon papers or whatever evidence is discussed is based on instruments that we had in the past and reports that we had in the past. And, of course, we should see what these are about and how credible the evidence is. But my point is, you know, the future can be much better than the past. We now have instruments, recording devices that are so much better, cameras and, you know, instruments that measure things much better than we had decades ago. So my point is simple. With a relatively modest funding, we can actually go to these sites, for example, the ocean where the Nimitz reported some unusual behavior. We can go to those places with an array of instruments and just, you know, do scientific measurements and see if there is anything unusual. We can simply repeat the experiment. I mean, in science, the evidence needs to be reproducible. Otherwise, you can't really tell if it's real or not. And why worry about these papers that are stuck in you know, that were stuck for decades or years in some drawers? I mean, I don't care much about them. I want to see the evidence myself.
The cases are ongoing. They're current, and they're using current technology to track them. The military is, yeah.
Okay, but it's of interest to the military because it could pose a national security risk, because perhaps other nations have technologies we don't know about. My point is, let's do the investigation in the open, using the standard scientific methodology, you know, like deploy the best instruments we have in those areas or in other areas, and just study, you know, what we see, what we detect. And, you know, you can just put the instruments. You don't need necessarily for the people to be there sitting and looking all the time, you know. We can just record what we get. And then if something unusual shows up, let's analyze it. Let's figure out. And instead of arguing about pieces of paper that are based on reports by pilots, you know, that are not really equipped to deal with scientific data, you know, as intriguing as it might be, we want to use instruments rather than people reporting about these things.
And, well, I think the pilots would probably disagree with you on this because they do have instruments and sensors. Sensors, and not just their own eyes, but sensors and radar and very sophisticated equipment. Yeah.
But if you think about this equipment, it was not designed for these phenomena. So you can't tell if there is malfunction of the equipment or something else going on. It was not a controlled experiment. I mean, they were flying the planes for a different purpose and they saw something unusual. My point is, let's do a scientific exploration of, you know, what's behind, what could be behind this.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it runs into the same problem that you've experienced is people don't want to do it. They don't want to put the money into it.
No,
they worry about the stigma.
The point is, we don't need the government. You don't want the government to give the money for this because otherwise it will be classified. You don't want, nowadays there is a lot of wealth in the private sector. So all you need to do is get someone wealthy interested in this. And then it will fund an exploration of this issue. And my point is, if there are people interested that have the money, we can go ahead and do the experiments, you know, and get the data rather than wait for these papers to be released and so forth. You know, science is not a mystical proposition. It's not something that we should debate about forever. Just if you have the money, you have the equipment, you go and do the experiment. And you should be able to say something meaningful about this subject. And we should strip it from all the obstacles that involve national security and magical thinking. You know, just go ahead and collect the data.
Dr. John Mack, Harvard Medical School, Pulitzer Prize winner, brilliant man, according to everyone who knew him, and I knew him. He ran into a buzzsaw when he started writing about these topics. They tried to strip his tenure. Are you familiar with that name and his experience?
No, I'm not familiar, but, you know, it really depends on what happened. And I'm not surprised that there is a lot of resistance to discussing this. But the point is we should focus on the ball, not on the audience here. And just do whatever is necessary to figure out the truth. I believe that this approach will win the day eventually, just as it, you know, people realize. Even the church now admits that the earth moves around the sun, right?
The church has an interest in these topics as well, Vatican astronomy and astronomers.
Yeah, so maybe they will fund it. You know, science has no preference for a particular, you know, religion or philosophical belief. I mean, the point is, we're trying to figure out the truth based on evidence, just like kids, you know. And I say, forget about, I mean, there is a lot of wasted energy in arguing about things all the time. And let's just collect the data, figure out what it is, and then revise. You know, it's just like a GPS system. It does recalculations whenever it goes to the wrong place. So if we end up finding that we had the wrong preconception, the wrong prejudice, we just recalculate.
We're talking with Dr. Avi Loeb about his new book, Extraterrestrial, which explores the controversy around Oumuamua. Some people think it's a spaceship, and some people think it's a rock. We'll open up the phone lines in a moment, hear what you think. We're talking with Dr. Avi Loeb about his new book, and it's looking at the Oumuamua case, this interstellar visitor, the evidence that it came from somewhere else and that it's manufactured, it's artificial, it's created by an ET civilization. In a moment, we go to the phone, see what's on your mind, calls, questions, comments from my guest. We'll be right back. All right, we're going to the phones. Dr. Avi Loeb is my guest. We're going to the wild card line, Jim in Newark. Hi, Jim.
Hey, George. You know you're one of my favorite guest hosts. Because you know how to play bumper music pertinent to the theme.
Well, thank you. What's on your mind?
And here, I didn't hear it real clearly. I had it on. But couldn't it be that if a Oumuamua is artificial, a calling card of a space race planning to make a landing all over the world?
Maybe that's going too far, but Dr. Loeb, could it be sent here on purpose to get our attention?
Well, first I should say that, again, out of modesty, I wouldn't think that we are interesting to anyone. But specifically to this object, it was moving very fast near the Earth. It, definitely didn't have any plan of landing here and was moving far from the Earth. And as I said, it took more than 10,000 years for it to cross the solar system. So it's not probably not intended specifically to spy on us or to get close to us. The question is, what is it? Even if it's artificial, what purpose does it serve? And we can look at the evidence, at the clues that we have. And this object came from the local standard of rest. And it could be a member of a grid of objects that serve as signposts in interstellar space for navigation purposes, you know, just like road posts. And to find your position, you need to look at them. And another possibility is that it's floating in space as a relay station for communication. You know, instead of producing a very powerful beacon that can be seen to great distances, you can imagine setting a network of relay stations the way we do on Earth. And that could be another possibility. But perhaps the more likely one is that it's some surface layer of another object, a spaceship or something, that was ripped apart, and it's just space junk. We are obviously deploying a lot of space junk in around, hovering around the Earth, but some of it may get outside the solar system, and it could be a defunct piece of equipment, something that was artificially made but is not functional anymore. We don't have enough data on this object to be able to tell what its purpose is. But hopefully, if we get a chance to see another one, then we can examine it.
And who's looking for it? I know with this discovery by the telescope in Hawaii,
So this telescope in Hawaii was intended to find all the asteroids that are bigger than roughly the size of Oumuamua that are potentially hazardous to Earth, that could impact the Earth and endanger us. These are called killer asteroids, and we know that dinosaurs died as a result of a big rock, tens of kilometers, roughly the size of Manhattan, that impacted the Earth. And they looked at the sky and saw this big rock approaching them. It must have been a beautiful sight, just seconds before it hit the ground. And they died, and we are better off because we have telescopes, we have science, we can alert ourselves to such incoming rocks. And that was the purpose of building PanSTARRS, and in the process of surveying the sky without any agenda, just looking at the sky and surveying it, it found this object, Oumuamua, from outside the solar system. And there is a much more sensitive telescope that is currently being constructed, called the Vera Rubin Observatory, that will have a survey of the sky called the LSST, much more sensitive than PanSTARRS, and we're looking forward to that. In a few years, it should start its operations in Chile.
There's a thought experiment that you describe in your book that you do with your students that to ponder the ideas about extraterrestrial life. Can you share that with us?
Students that attend my freshman seminar, I asked them if a spaceship landed on Earth and they could board it, would they go? And to my surprise, they said yes, but under one condition, that they would be able to share through social media their experiences there with their friends. And I found that very strange, because if I would go to the Himalayas, I wouldn't care less about sharing it with anyone. I would just enjoy the experience, and especially dealing with extraterrestrials. I mean, that would be an amazing experience. And if I would also board such a ship, but I wouldn't care less about other people, sharing my experience with me.
We'll go back to the phones. Let's see, on the west of the Rockies, Howard in Vancouver. Hi, Howard.
Thank you, George. I had a thought I'd like to share with Professor Loeb. You mentioned early on that this object was tumbling slowly every 8 hours or so.
Right.
I am thinking that if this really was a extraterrestrial craft of some sort, perhaps they found it necessary to rotate the craft to prevent exposing one portion of the craft to the solar radiation. I know that that's done with some of our spacecraft. I'm just wondering what you might think about that.
Yeah, so that's interesting. But the period of the tumbling was 8 hours, so relatively short compared to the passage around the sun. And therefore, I mean, it could have served some purpose, but most likely I would think it implies that the object is not functional, that it is, you know, it's just tumbling because it lost its control, so to speak. And that would be my natural interpretation, but it's possible that I'm wrong and there is a purpose to this tumbling.
Thanks, Howard. Appreciate it. First-time caller Jay in Florida. Hi, Jay. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Hey, good morning, George. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm a law enforcement officer, and you guys keep me company for many, many nights. So
excellent.
That.
Excellent.
Doctor, I wonder, I have a personal question. I had an uncle, Thomas, who worked at the Gordon McKay Physics Lab at Harvard University. I wonder if you might know him.
No.
No? Okay. Secondly, and this may have been asked and answered, but are there any at all measurable signals coming from Oumuamua at all?
Yeah, so as soon as it was discovered, just a couple of weeks later, I spoke with Yuri Milner, an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley that funds search for radio signals from other stars, search for civilizations that transmit radio signals. And so we agreed that it would be useful to use the telescopes to which his project Breakthrough Listen has access to, and just look at the Oumuamua to see if there is any radio signal. And the answer was nothing was detected at the level of a cell phone. So, but we obviously we looked at the radio frequencies that these telescopes are sensitive to, and also if there was a transmission, it could have been directed in a completely different direction, not towards Earth, and also it could be sporadic, you know, not all the time, and we didn't look at the right time, and who knows, but we didn't detect anything. We gave it a try just for fun. We didn't see any radio signal coming from it.
Thanks for the call, Jay. Back to the wild card line, Mark in Buffalo. Hi, Mark.
Hi, George. You're my favorite. I'll be quick. Professor, how many astronomical units away is it? What is the absolute and apparent magnitude? What is the velocity? What is the constellation it's heading toward? And last question is, can we catch it with a probe or spacecraft? I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Excellent question. Yes. But instead of me just mentioning all these details quickly, I recommend you have a look at my book that is coming out in a week. It's called Extraterrestrials, where I detail all these details about the object. It was moving at a fraction of an astronomical unit from us when it came by, and it's now going in a different direction than obviously it came into the solar system from. And I show a sketch of the direction so you can look at it. And they also mention how bright it was. And you can find those also on Wikipedia and under Oumuamua. But altogether, you know, what we should focus on are the peculiar properties of this object, not so much the properties that are shared by any astronomical object of a similar size, you know, like a comet or an asteroid. We should focus our attention on why is it different from everything that we had seen before. Why do astronomers need to invoke, even if they think of a natural origin, why do they need to discuss something that was never seen before, an object that we've never witnessed? And that has to do with the unusual properties that it has, not so much the brightness or the size or the path that it went through, but all the other things that I mentioned before.
You make the point in the book, Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Life Beyond Earth, that chances are we're never going to be able to confirm whether it is or isn't a spacecraft, but because we're not going to be able to catch it. The best we can hope for is maybe to be ready when the next one comes in.
Yeah, so the problem is it's moving fast. It was moving faster than any rocket that we currently have, and we couldn't catch with it, but also it was receding from us. And by now, it's a million times fainter than it was when it was close to us, because it reflects sunlight, and as you move away from the sun, the amount of sunlight reflected gets down inversely with distance to the fourth power, and you can't really see it. So we should give a chance to the next object around to be found, and once we find that, we can probably learn much more about it. I think it's very unlikely that this object is the only one around, because we just looked at the sky with pan stars for a few years, and we're sensitive to an object of this type within an astronomical unit, roughly the distance, the separation of the Earth from the Sun, and we found this one. So there should be, I would think that there should be one such object for every period of region of the size that is associated with the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. So there are plenty of them in the solar system, and we just need to search for more. We shouldn't agonize on one plastic bottle when there are so many on the beach.
You mentioned the name of Yuri Milner, this Russian guy who became a Silicon Valley titan, who's interested in these topics and is willing to spend some money to check it out. You were introduced to him and found yourself on stage with Freeman Dyson and Stephen Hawking to announce a project. Can you tell us where that project stands?
Yeah, so this is a project to visit the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, within our lifetime. It takes light 4 years to traverse the distance to that star, but so if we want to get there within, let's say, 20 years, you need to build a spacecraft that can move at a fifth of the speed of light. And the question is how to do that. And Starshot aims to do that with the light sail technology that I mentioned before, by pushing a lightweight sail that weighs maybe a gram or a few grams with a very powerful laser that is focused on it. One can reach a fraction of the speed of light in a few minutes if the laser has 100 gigawatts. And the spacecraft itself would be relatively cheap. Most of the cost is the infrastructure of the laser. So we are currently working on the main challenges of this project, which is the photon engine, we call it, or the laser, creating a coherent laser beam, and also perfecting the type of material and structure of the sail. And then the next challenge would be the communication between the sail when it gets close to the target, between the spacecraft and Earth. These are huge distances, and communication is not trivial at all. So it's a challenging project. We announced it in 2016 in New York City with Stephen Hawking, who on the same trip, he also visited my home and for Passover, and we had dinner. He was very excited by this project, but his visit also helped us inaugurate the Black Hole Initiative that I'm the director of at Harvard. So that was the second purpose for his visit. This is a center that studies black holes, and the only center in the world that focuses on black holes and brings together mathematicians, physicists, astronomers, and philosophers to study black holes, which is a very trendy, it's very much in vogue right now. There were two Nobel Prizes awarded in the last 3 years to the study of black holes.
You make the one other point. We got about a minute left, but you make the point in your book that anomalies, the importance of anomalies, and how I interpreted what you're saying is that there's things that are classified as anomalies. One scientist looks at the same data a different way and realizes the importance of it, but anomalies can be a real kickstarter for making important discoveries. You can make a big jump in our understanding of the universe.
That's right. Anomalies are the key to revising our understanding. When we see something that doesn't quite match what we expected, that's exactly what advances our understanding. And the way I view science, as we started the conversation, the way I view science is a learning experience. And anomalies are the tool that help us figure out that what we thought before is not correct, that in fact, reality is different because it doesn't quite match what we expected. And I think Oumuamua is one such example. And even if it's of natural origin and not artificial, it's something that we have never seen before. And we will learn in the process. So we should examine such objects carefully.
Absolutely. Dr. Loeb, thank you so much for getting up early to be with us. I encourage people to check out your book. It's coming out in a couple of days, Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Life Beyond Earth. It's a terrific read, and I can't thank you enough again for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And thanks to my earlier guests, Leslie Kane and Ricky Stern, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Michael Cosio and Donna Walker, webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galante, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night, and I'm not going to give you too much of a hint, but you're going to want to check this out. Good night, everyone.